Thank you for that prayer, brother. Good morning to each of you. I'm going to go ahead and go through this in sort of a lecture kind of format, and then hopefully if we have some time, we will have some discussion. So I'm going to try to get through this just as quickly as we can. This is where this handout on the key to successful marriage really, you know, comes in, and so that's there for you for your reference, and also on page 21 of your notebook of handouts, I've got an interactive outline. I think that will help you a great deal as we go through today's material. And if you are here today and you would like to have one of these separately, Mo is here to pass these out. So raise your hand if you need the interactive outline for today's class. This is part two of, I call this A Marriage That Works. No amount of personal or professional success will make up for failure in the home. J.P. Morgan, who was sort of the Warren Buffett of the 19th century, one of the richest men of his day, said he would gladly exchange his billions in exchange for one good marriage. Shows you the value of a good marriage and a meaningful home life. And how sad it is when things don't work out. Years ago, I was riding along and I looked up and there was a car in front of me with a bumper sticker and it read, "Love is the wine of life, marriage is the hangover." And I thought, wow, I mean, this guy must have really had a problem. And of course, I don't know, it may have been a woman as well. But it's very sad how many marriages start off with great expectations, but they don't end well. And so we want to talk about principles that will not only help people that are currently married, but also equip any of you that may know people that are having some marriage challenges as to have some resources and some tools to point them to that will help them improve their marriage. There is hope, and there are ways that marriages can heal and that romantic love can be reborn, which is what we talked about in our session Saturday. By the way, if you missed the first session, I'm going to do a real quick review, but if you missed the first session on this Saturday, session 2, it's available on the website. These three lessons are integral. They all go together, and they don't really make that much sense apart. So please make sure you get all three of these messages. Okay, as I've been saying, and I will continue to repeat, the key to a successful marriage is pretty simple. Both must learn to care, and that is meet each other's needs, understand what they are, communicate them, and then become an expert. Work hard at meeting your top emotional needs of your mate. More about that during our worship period. And then, very importantly, to protect each other from hurt and offense. In other words, avoid making withdrawals from the love bank. And I put together a primer to go along with Dr. Willard Harley's books on His Needs, Her Needs, and Love Busters. And it's just recently been professionally typeset. I hope they'll be a great tool for you to use. And they are available for you in the back if you need a set of those. So, this is a three-part series. We did part one Saturday afternoon. Today, during Bible class, we're going to look at a very important aspect here of avoiding withdrawals. I call it overcoming love busters. And then during the worship, we'll be looking at meeting each other's needs. Okay, so we looked in the very first installment of this at the love bank, the idea that the key to passion is just simply keep the love bank full. And it's a good idea to periodically ask your spouse, "How's your love bank? How you doing today? What can I do to help fill it?" You'll get some very interesting feedback from that. And I usually wind up doing a bunch of chores. But whatever. The point is, try to fill up the love bank the best you can. And then secondly, the romantic myth. I won't talk about that today. We don't have time. But that is a terrible lie. Just something that a lot of people buy into, and they should not. And it's a problem. And then the importance of habits, which, again, we talked about in part one. And the key is just simply to just decide that you're going to develop habits that build up marital love rather than tear it down. And then, of course, we introduce the idea of love busters, which we're going to look in detail today during the Bible class. All right, so how do we keep it alive? Well, it's all about love, right? And 1 Corinthians 13 gives us these eight verbs. Love is not so much how you feel. Love is what you do. And it's just being determined to treat each other in kind and considerate ways that follow the principles of 1 Corinthians 13. And I mentioned in part two yesterday that my advice to couples is just, you know, I know you're having difficulties. Focus in on being kind. Focus in on being loving. Treat each other in appropriate manners, and the feelings will follow. That's the key. So even though you think your love is dead or we don't love one another anymore, that's garbage. Just decide to love one another and trust that the feelings will follow. So, put it bluntly, we're looking today at Love Busters. There's an excellent book by Dr. Harley on this. And he says, protect your marriage by replacing love-busting patterns with love-building habits. And he goes through what I'm talking about today in great detail. I'm going to lay out the biblical principles involved because we're Bible students. But in the meantime, we have this paradigm that will really help us practically apply these biblical principles. And I've tried lots of different things with couples over 40-plus years, and there's nothing that I found more effective and more impactful than what I'm sharing with you in this meeting. All right, so, love busters. Let's remember, it is defined as a destructive marital habit. Now, we all at times, because we're human, right? We're all at times are going to frustrate, annoy, irritate, maybe even hurt each other's feelings, and we need to give each other grace because nobody's perfect, right? So that happens, and that's not going to destroy marriage. The problem is not that occasionally you sort of wake up on the wrong side of the bed and you're kind of short with your spouse every once in a while. Welcome to the human race. The problem is when you have a habitual pattern that dogs your steps and that the other party begins to live in fear of and even dread the exchange because it winds up coming up frequently. Dr. Harley put it this way, when negative acts are repeatable and predictable, love suffers great loss. So that's what we're talking about when we deal with love busters. They're habitual habits that just consistently make withdrawals from the love bank, and that will destroy a marriage quicker than about anything that I know. So, number one, love buster, very common, I deal with this all the time, it's just angry outburst. This is typically, you get into an argument, and before you can discuss it and stay rational, things begin to escalate, and then somebody starts yelling, and they say something usually out of anger. This is where you say it in a way that is not only harsh and out of anger, but it's a way to punish or to get back at the other party. And this creates disrespect. And by the way, sometimes saying something with a firm tone certainly has its place. Maybe even raising your voice occasionally to make a point, you know, that has its place. I don't want to be extreme here, but yelling at each other, having a yelling match, that is never appropriate and it is degrading. You know, you start yelling at me, it's like, what is going on here? Completely shut down the communication process. So angry outbursts is a problem. And it's something that if a person has that characteristic, they just need to realize that's just a bad habit. Don't say that's just the way I am. You don't have to stay that way. Just decide that, you know, the louder they get, the softer you get. You know, you're just not going to fall into that. A good example of a angry outburst we find in regards to Job's wife. And of course, Job has lost all of his children in one day. Man, what a tragic loss. You know, can you imagine? He loses his treasure, his family, then later on his health. And is his wife there by his side being supportive of him at this moment? No. She says, no doubt, in an angry outburst, you know, do you still hold fast to your integrity? It's like, what's wrong with you? Why don't you just curse God and die? I think maybe Job would have been better off if his wife had died with all of his kids. Now, in her defense, she went through all of this loss as well. So, you know, you got to cut her some slack there. But still, that was not her finest moment. And that kind of angry outburst could be just so hurtful and certainly go into long-term memory. The Bible warns about this in the Old and New Testament. So let's look at some godly wisdom. James chapter 1, very familiar passage. Be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. And Solomon says, he who is quick-tempered acts foolishly, and I might add, so frequently says things that they're going to later regret. And then thirdly, there is one who speaks like the piercing of a sword, but the tongue of the wise promotes healing. So, choose your words carefully, for you later may have to eat them, right? So, as I said, most of the time this is just a bad habit that needs to be dealt with. All right, the second love buster, and this is very common. It's often not understood or articulated very well, so understanding this so you can identify it and get rid of it is very important. And this is known as disrespectful judgment. You remember we said earlier that the day that your spouse stops being your biggest cheerleader and starts becoming your biggest critic, that's when the bloom is off the rose. You know, you want to avoid somebody who's constantly critical of you, right? So you don't want to let that happen. You want to have valid communication. And we talked about giving and receiving criticism yesterday as well. That's why that's so an important part of this series. But you don't want to be a caustic critic. This is where you impose your values on the other person in a way that is disrespectful. It's one thing to disagree with your spouse about something, and I encourage couples to work toward what I call respectful persuasion. And it's another thing just to be involved in put-downs. This is where you're rude and arrogant and disrespectful. Let me give you some examples. A wife says to her husband, "If you had any taste, you'd see that tie looks terrible with that suit." Well, why couldn't somebody say, "Honey, don't you think this tie would go better than the one you're wearing?" I mean, that's fine. But to say you don't have any taste, that's a disrespectful judgment. Or here's another one. If you were normal, you'd understand that you squeeze the toothpaste from the bottom, not the middle. What is wrong with you? I mean, that's kind of one of those annoying trifles that, you know, tremendous trifles that oftentimes can be sort of funny, but can be withdrawals from the love bank. Talk about them respectfully instead of with a put down. Here's another one, very common. If it wasn't for your mother, you wouldn't think that or act that way. It's the way you were raised, that's the problem. Man, those are fighting words. You start attacking somebody's mother? And yet, that kind of stuff happens all the time. I know of one case where the wife was upset with her husband for not being more industrious and maybe not working as hard as he should at his job. And the wife says, "You are just a loser, a lazy louse." Is that very productive? That kind of childish name-calling? I mean, why not, honey, do you think maybe you could be showing more initiative in finding a job? I mean, that would be okay. But just to call somebody a lazy louse and a loser? Not very productive. And if that's the kind of feedback you get from your spouse, who's supposed to be your soulmate, man, I wonder those marriages tend not to last. So, again, we want good communication. But it has to be done respectfully. In James chapter 4, we have the following question. It says, "Do not speak evil of one another, brethren. There is one lawgiver who is able to destroy. Who are you to judge another?" And so, the Bible tells us to judge righteous judgments, John 7, verse 24. We're not saying you don't make judgments. We're saying you don't make disrespectful judgments. Because love, 1 Corinthians 13, verse 5, does not insist on its own way, right? And it is not rude. A loving person isn't rude to the other person in their relationship. Let me share something with you that I think is relevant here. You know, when I was growing up, we talked a lot about the problem of prejudice and people struggling with prejudice in all types of different contexts. But now the rhetoric has been so heightened and it's so divisive where people are constantly calling each other racist. And, you know, if you say something that somebody else has defined as maybe an inappropriate way to say something or whatever, then, oh, you're just a racist. Wow, you talk about a disrespectful judgment. I'm not saying that racism isn't a problem, but if everything becomes racist, then the real racism really doesn't get dealt with. And it's the ultimate disrespectful judgment to call somebody a racist. I mean, first of all, do you know that for sure? Can you read people's hearts? I mean, that is the most disrespectful thing you can say. It's one of the worst sins out there. And to so quickly be branding whole groups of people as racist is just so inappropriate. And oftentimes an unfair slander against the other person's character that just shuts down any meaningful conversation. So we live in a culture where that's happening all the time, and we need to be careful that we don't let that happen to us as part of God's family. All right, next is annoying behaviors. This is doing something that irritates the other party consistently. And the book of Proverbs talks about one of these tremendous trifles. Solomon says, if someone blesses his friend with a loud voice early in the morning, it will be taken as a curse. You know, it must be God's sense of humor. It seems like night owls marry morning doves. You know, oftentimes that's the case. I like this little meme, you know. Here's this person going, you know, will you please be quiet? I'm trying to sleep. You know, if someone rises up early in the morning and is singing all these songs, and this person over here is saying, do I look like I do mornings? See, now, that's the way I look about mornings. But the point is that we laugh at these kind of things, but annoying behaviors over time can really take a toll on the love bank, especially if the other person isn't trying to be somewhat considerate of the other person's needs in that circumstance. It's doing something that irritates the other party consistently. Now, I find this fascinating. Women tend to find men, on average, more annoying than men find women. Now, I've had discussions at marriage seminars and things about this. And the women will say, well, that's because men are just naturally more annoying than next women. And then the men will say, no. It's because we men are just more tolerant and less irritated. You know what? I'm not going to even weigh in on that debate this morning. But it's fascinating how most of the time it's the man that annoys the woman rather than the reverse. And so you need to make a commitment to be considerate. Let me give you some examples. When we first got married, one of the things that I did that really annoyed Gail, was hard for me to change, was if I'm reading a magazine or a book and I get to a stopping place, I will dog-ear the page of the book so I can come back to it. That's what we did in my family. And so it's just something that, you know, second nature. We didn't use bookmarks. My wife thought that was the most tacky thing. She goes, you've been reading my magazines. Here you are again. You've dog-eared the pages. What are you? Keep on ruining my magazines. Ruin? That seemed like a strong word. I said, I'm sorry, honey. I don't even... So I tried to stop, but I just so frequently would forget because I needed to establish a new habit. And so, believe me, I will not dog-ear the page of a book anymore. I use a bookmark because that really bothers my wife. Right? So a lot of times someone will say, well, why don't you just get over it? Why don't you just decide you're not going to be bothered by somebody dog-earing the pages of a book? Well, it just doesn't work that way. Usually, it's much easier for the other person to accommodate the annoyance. But a lot of times, you have issues with one party is always late. there's a couple at Kirkland that they always take two cars, and the wife always comes in about 5 minutes late. And, you know, the husband's embarrassed, and he's not going to be late, so they take two cars. It's a constant withdrawal from the love bank, particularly in regards to the husband, because the wife has a bad habit of just running late everywhere. Maybe it's table matters, like eating with your mouth open or something like that, or poor posture, or constantly tapping and rubbing your fingers, you know, like this. I mean, it's no big deal. The other person that's doing it probably doesn't realize it, but that can drive somebody sort of up the wall. Maybe it is falling asleep on the couch with your mouth open. And here you are just taking a nap, and your wife comes home, and it's just not a very good picture. And it's a withdrawal from the love bank. Somebody says, you mean I'm asleep and I'm making withdrawals from the love bank? Yep, if that's an annoying behavior for your wife. Go into another room and fall asleep, but not in a situation where that's constantly going to be a problem. Sometimes women spend a lot of time primping in front of the mirror in the bathroom and getting ready, and that can be an annoyance to the husband. A lot of these things seem trivial, and they are, but let me tell you, over the years, it can be really irritating, and it can get on the other person's nerves. And one of the things that frequently happens is these things don't come up when you're dating, but especially bathroom habits, right? You share a bathroom together. I laugh and I say, you can get two bathrooms and have separate bathrooms, you're probably going to get along a lot better in your marriage, because that's often where you have these things come up. All right, so try to accommodate the other person as much as possible and avoid these annoying behaviors. And take them seriously. Don't ignore them, because steady, regular withdrawals take its toll on how you feel about one another. All right, then there's selfish demands. Obviously, demands choke out love. It's one thing to request something of your spouse. It's another thing to make selfish demands. You can have a slave or a lover, but you cannot have both. I'm talking here about threats, lectures, things that are viewed as manipulative, which build resentment and causes the other party discomfort. When you talk to your spouse, you talk adult to adult. You don't talk adult to child. It's very important that you're not too parental with your spouse. You ought to know better. You should be doing this. You know, it's again, it kind of becomes one of these disrespectful judgments. Let me see here. I'm having trouble reading my writing. Yeah, commanding your spouse to do things that benefit you at your spouse's expense, with the implied threat of punishment if you refuse, is the problem here. You know, you better do this or else. That's not the way a marriage functions, where you start making those kind of ultimatums toward each other. And so the Bible says, again, love does not insist on its own way. Another example of this is Delilah pressuring Samson. Now, you're familiar with the story. You know, she keeps on begging Samson to tell her what's the secret of his strength. And he keeps on lying to her about what it is. And then she keeps on doing those things that he said will take away his strength. And after the first time that she betrays him and these men come in to kill him, man, he should have gotten rid of Delilah right away. I mean, that was ridiculous. I called Samson, I have a sermon called Strong But Stupid. And he was when it came to Delilah. Truly crazy. But that was a selfish demand. I mean, she didn't care about him. She was going to get paid money if she figured out the secret of his strength and the Philistine people could go after Samson. So the ultimate example of a disloyal and harmful kind of selfish demand was Delilah pressuring Samson. The Bible says, let nothing be done through selfish ambition, but let each of you look not to your own interest, but also for the interest of others. So ask the other party, now, how would you feel about this if I do this? You know, try to make sure you're on the same page here. When occasionally a preacher will get a call about the congregation inquiring about, you know, you want to maybe move and work with us. I mean, you don't just talk to the church and then come home and announce to your wife, guess what, we're moving to Kirkland, Washington. I mean, you pray about it together. You talk with him about it together. You try to make that a joint decision because that has a huge impact on her, right? That's a good example. I've heard of preachers doing that, and I think, what is wrong with you? That's not just your decision to make. It has to be a joint decision. So avoid selfish decisions, selfish demands. All right, and then there's dishonesty. Now, this is interesting because you remember that honesty and being honest is also one of the emotional needs that has to be met. But this is also the opposite of this. Dishonesty is a huge love buster. The reason why dishonesty is such a love buster is it breaks down trust. One of the things you'll find is that a breaking of trust, trust goes out in buckets, but it comes back in drops. And so if you catch your spouse lying to you about something, not only is that a huge withdrawal from the love bank and a violation of trust, but now you wonder, well, what else have you lied to me about? Now everything else comes into question. And it is so devastating to the relationship. I mean, who wants to live with a liar, right? Where you have to question everything. Now here's the key. Reveal to your spouse your thoughts, feelings, habits, likes, dislikes, personal history, daily activities, plans for the future, anything they really have a right to know. So this is more than just overtly lying. This is keeping information from your spouse that is deception. Do you know that in something like 50% of marriages, there's something that marriage and family literature calls financial infidelity? It's where you do things secretly behind your spouse's back with the money and don't tell them. And then later on they find out that this college fund for their kids have been raided or something. And you know, you've got to understand that you put the money together in a common pot and it's our money and you need to make joint decisions about that. And to make major financial decisions without even telling your other half, that's a great example of a huge withdrawal that violates trust and is a sign of dishonesty. About 30 years ago, I'll never forget this, I had a dear friend of mine who got married, and immediately, right after the honeymoon, the woman came to me, and she was just heartbroken, and they had a terrible honeymoon. On their wedding night, he revealed to her that he was not interested in having any children. And she was just heartbroken. I mean, don't you normally assume that if you get married, the children kind of are a part of the picture? Well, for whatever reason, he didn't want to have any children. And she said, well, why didn't you talk to me about this earlier? He goes, listen, I did not ever tell you that I wanted children. I just avoided the subject. And so now you're bringing it up? Why didn't you bring it up sooner so we could talk about it? He said, because I was afraid if I told you that, you wouldn't marry me. So now she feels tricked. That was where the trust just goes out in buckets. And guess what? It wasn't too long until the wall of resentment and distrust got bigger and bigger and higher and higher, and it ultimately led to a divorce. So even though he didn't technically lie to her about it, that was something that he needed to discuss in advance before she got married. You get the point? So those things are really important. And of course, the Bible is so filled with this. We've got the example of Jacob deceiving Isaac in the darkness of his blindness and in a serendipitous matter, getting the blessing. And what did that do to his family? What happened with the relationship with his brother? It took over 20 years to straighten that mess out. God had told him that he was going to get the blessing. He didn't need to go through all of this. And yet that deception just caused so much problem in this family that God had specially anointed as the one through whom the Messiah would come. Therefore, putting away lying, and each one speak truth one to another. Do not lie one to another. The Bible, of course, says, all liars shall have their part in the lake of fire. And a memory verse we had our kids memorize. Lying is an abomination to Jehovah, but those who deal truthfully are his delight. I tell couples that it's better to just tell the truth and take the heat and get in trouble if you've done something you shouldn't have done. than it is to try to cover it up and lie about it. The cover-up is always worse than the, quote, initial crime. So, keep those things in mind. And the last love buster is independent behavior. And that's where the conduct of one spouse is conceived and executed as if the other spouse does not even exist. It's kind of like the example I gave of the preacher just coming down and telling his wife, guess what, we're moving. I'm not talking about unhealthy dependency here. I'm talking instead about focusing in on interdependent behavior, where the conduct of both spouses nurtures and protects each other. You're not in a sole proprietorship. You are in a partnership. And it ought to be cooperative. And it needs to be made with, you know, understanding how your decisions impact the spouse. I know of one couple where, you know, the husband went out and bought a new car and just drove it home. And, you know, the wife felt like they couldn't afford it, and it wasn't even a car she liked, and it was one of the things that led to ultimately the end of their marriage. It was just the decision to go out independently and put this car on credit because he wanted it without concern for her feelings. I know of another couple where she grew up where there was some conflict around the dinner table, and so she doesn't like to sit around and eat together with her husband. So she will fix him meals, but then he has to eat by himself. And she eats by herself later at another time. I'm trying to get her to understand. I know you've got some triggers from the past, but it is just so unfair to your husband to have him be married and have to always eat by himself. Separate vacations, separate friends, no regard for how you plan things together that are going to be beneficial to both. And so independent behavior, in a way, is just another one of those selfish demands, right? And it needs to be avoided. Remember, the Bible says, what God has joined together, let not man put asunder. Therefore, you are no longer two, but one, and you need to act accordingly. Okay, so those are the love busters. And that's the first thing you got to deal with. When I sit down in marriage counseling, I say, okay, let's talk about these love busters. And I want you to rate each other's love busters. And you'll notice on this special Key to a Successful Marriage handout, I've got some charts here. And there's pages there where you can rate your spouse's love busters on a scale of 1 to 5. You know, 1 would be the one that's the worst, and then the 5th is the one that's not the least problem. Or you may find in some cases, no, we're always honest with each other. That's not an issue at all. Well, that would be NA, non-applicable. But you rate each other's love busters and you start working on getting rid of those first and foremost. It's not so much the presence of good traits, it's the absence of bad. That is so important. So, as the Bible says, you first and foremost overcome every superfluity of wickedness, right? So, you can't do all of these all at once, but you do one at a time. And that's your biggest enemy in your marriage. And frankly, that's your biggest enemy with your roommate, if you're not married, or with your best friends. This goes with all relationships. Get rid of those bad traits, those bad habits. And confess them before God as a sin and ask Him to help you deal with it. Because when you have consistent love busting and withdrawals from the love bank, I can guarantee you, romantic love is going to be the victim. Love deposits will not be received because you've got this wall of resentment up. You can't trust the other person. They're dishonest, or they're constantly yelling at you, or there's these angry outbursts. And just to be really honest, are you going to be very amorous and very affectionate with someone that treats you that way? I mean, I can just tell you, that's not going to do much for the bedroom if this is going on behind the scenes in the relationship. Love deposits will not be received until the love busters are dealt with. And be careful, because a few major withdrawals or love busters can undo scores of prior deposits. not the presence of good traits, it's the absence of bad. So here's some six tips to overcome. First of all, you have to really be committed and yet have patience, because it's difficult to overcome habits. I mean, I couldn't believe how many times I forgot about I'm not supposed to dog ear the pages of my wife's books and magazines. It was just a little thing, but it was just hard for me to get over that habit. So be patient, because if the other person is trying, just pray for them and eventually they'll get it. And do things one at a time. It's unrealistic to try to do three or four at once if you've got three or four love busters in your relationship. It's just overwhelming. Focus in on the one that's the biggest issue to your spouse and prayerfully deal with that. Also, identify the why and work to avoid triggers. In other words, what is it that kind of makes you angry or causes you to respond with an angry outburst? Can you avoid those triggers? Develop alternative behaviors, righteous substitutes, I call it. Maybe at the time you start to raise your voice, if you tend to be a yeller, you can go like this, give each other a time out. That's what I tell couples to do. Just time out. Just walk away. This is not going well. You care about each other too much to say something you're going to regret. Calm down and then return later and discuss it. Alternative behaviors that are going to avoid things that are really negative. If you're one that's constantly going like this, maybe you ought to get a stress ball, right? And just squeeze the stress ball, and that doesn't make any sound. It's not irritating. So there are things you can do that are easy, that are substitutes. And ask your mate for evaluation weekly. How am I doing? And go through this and give each other some sense of hope that we're making progress here. We're getting rid of these things that make withdrawals from the love bank or that hurt or offend each other. And the key to do that, of course, is you have to communicate this successfully, clearly, without being defensive. And so that's where you rate your mate's forms. I go through this in counseling, and I have them right there in front of me go through and rate these things. When I do these in lectures like this, people often tell me, well, this is really good, helpful information. But then later on, I find out that they never went home and processed the information as a couple. Please go home and process this. The transformation comes in the application, not just in the hearing and the understanding. So go home if you're married and rate each other's love busters and talk about it, please. And see if you can't improve. It will make a huge difference. And each spouse has to really listen without being defensive and then begin to develop good habits. The example I like to use is, let's take a love bucket. And you fill up the love bucket with all these positive things, okay, that help you to feel like I'm really fortunate to be married to this person. This is my soulmate. First thing you've got to do is get rid of the leaks. You know, if there's holes in the love bucket, you do all these nice things for each other, but then it goes out, you've got to plug up the holes. That's what you do when you deal with the love busters. It's like plugging up the love bucket. Now we can focus on making deposits. That's where it really gets rich and meaningful. And that's what we're going to talk about during the worship period. So, no amount of personal or professional success will make up for failure in the home. And it's just so important for us to recognize that our needs can be met. And the love bank, as we apply these biblical principles, will enable us to have not just marriages, but relationships that work. The key is to learn to care, find out what the needs are, and care enough to meet them, and to protect each other from things that cause harm or hurt. And once you do that, you will have a marriage that works. Okay, we got a couple of minutes here for discussion. And I'm telling you, as a marriage counselor, if people will wrap their arms around this and apply it, it makes a huge difference. And the key is to do things early, if you possibly can, rather than wait till it's too late. All right, let me see your hands. Anybody got any feedback or questions? Yes, sir.
I'm sure you're familiar with Homer Haley.
Oh, yes.
We had him in our gospel meeting, and I asked him what he was changing his life, because he's well known for going everywhere to have gospel meetings and teachings. And he said, I would spend more time with my family.
Yes. Yeah, I heard him say that at a gospel meeting years ago. He said, you know, I've been somewhat of a success. He was being modest as an author. He's written many wonderful commentaries. He goes, I've been somewhat a success as a college administrator. He was vice president of Florida College, head of the Bible department. He went through this long list of all of these achievements. But he said, I've been a complete failure as a father. And he goes, I grieve that I think 3 of his 5 kids were unfaithful at the time. And he said, I just spent too much time working, too much time in my study, even too much time memorizing scripture. And I neglected my family. And if I had it to do over again, he said, I would rather have been a failure as an author, a failure as an evangelist, a failure as a college administrator, and a successful husband and father. And
you said our priorities.
Yes, it goes back to lesson 1, doesn't it? Keep your priorities straight. That's exactly right. So thank you for reminding me of that. That's a great memory of Brother Homer Haley. All right. Anybody else? Yes, sir.
Yeah, in thinking of marriage, I just entering the kingdom unmarried and meeting my wife in the church, I do believe it sets up for a greater dynamic than being yoked with an unbeliever in the situation that we're talking about in marriages. And it takes a lot of humility to be in God's kingdom, to hear messages like from people like yourself and others, to absorb it and not say, yep, we've already fully arrived. That aspect of you think to yourself, well, we have a great marriage, blah, blah, blah. But I realize he who has will be given more.
Yes.
But he who does not have, even when he has, will be taken from him. So I'm realizing,
Matthew 25.
It's not how good a marriage is, even if our marriage is good. It's what you're doing with that marriage to benefit and help other people in the kingdom. So
yeah,
that's what stirs my thinking on.
Well, thank you for that, because I want to have a marriage that glorifies God, right? I want to have people see this wonderful relationship I have with my wife, and we can give God the glory for it, right? And often people say, well, I want what you have. Well, then you talk to them about the Lord, right? And so wouldn't it be great if the world looked at us like the pagans looked at the early church and said, well, I disagree with them on X, Y, and Z, but boy, do they have wonderful marriages and families. And you know, our friends the Mormons, you know, they've got some strange doctrines. But they are known for having strong family life. And that's what draws a lot of people to the Mormon church. That ought to be the case with churches of Christ. It's not, but it should. And I want to try to be a part of trying to help us focus more on marriage and not just divorce. I know you guys are on that page.